Use what gifts you have to serve one another. Use what gifts you have to serve one another. Now, we began this lesson some time ago with a list of one another's in the scripture. This is one of them. Use what gifts you have to serve one another. We began the lesson by saying that over some large number of millennia, our bodies have adapted to the rotation of the earth. You notice that the earth spins on its axis once every 24 hours, and so we have somehow adapted to that reality, and so our bodies need 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night in order to be working optimally. Our bodies have adapted over these same millennia. We began with by saying, by eating the plants and the animals that share this planet with us, we've adapted to leafy greens, and we've adapted to omega-3s and all that kind of stuff, and our bodies have adapted to the energy demands that are required by roaming far afield in forest and in plain in search of our food, and so we need today to have a certain amount of sleep, we need to have a certain kind of food, and we need to have a body that regularly exercises. However, the agricultural industry being what it is, and our sedentary jobs being what they are, and the sleep-limiting lifestyles that we have, burning the candle at night, burning a candle in the morning, it makes it very easy for us to eat and to sleep and to exercise in a way that is at odds with the way that our bodies are, instead of working in concert with the way that our bodies are. And we can do that, we said. As a matter of fact, it's easy to do that. However, when we do so, we do it at odds with our own well-being. We can go with the flow, and the flow is to eat easy foods. Easy foods are usually processed, and usually foods come to us very conveniently, nicely packaged, and they will yet be stripped of the nutrients that our body needs. And we can deny our bodies the sleep that they need, staying up late, getting up early. In fact, it's easier to do those things because we've got all kinds of electronic gadgets that encourage us to do so. And it's a whole lot easier to sit at our desk all day and come home and sit on our couch all night. These things are easier to do. So, in this society, at this time in history, it takes intentionality and it takes work and it takes honoring the needs of our bodies purposefully in order to move toward working with our bodies as our bodies are. And that wasn't our point. Our point was to think of that as a metaphor for the way that our interior beings go. The dynamic that we live in every day has the same process going on. Over these hundreds of thousands of years that we have practiced being human, hundreds of thousands of years of using this big brain of ours, these years of making a go on this planet, these years of experiencing the physical world of tangible and touchable, but having these glimpses of moments where we see the transcendent. Having done this for all this time, we wake up inside of these beings of ours and we find ourselves to be deeply communal beings and deeply spiritual beings. And waking up to find that about ourselves, we have a choice. We can ignore our spirituality. We can ignore our communality. In fact, that is also very easy to do. We live in a ruggedly individualistic society. Our academic elite tend to discredit spirituality. And so it is easy to deny the spiritual communal nature of our humanity. That's easy to do, and many are. And as we do, our culture pays a steep price. The most primal of our relationships, our love relationships, our family relationships, are fracturing at alarmingly accelerating paces. The social fabric of our culture together is slowly being torn apart. The simple contract of communal trust is violated. How many of us trust the corporations, to be honest with us? How many of us trust our politicians, to be honest with us? How many of us trust the marketing people who will sell us stuff? We don't, because the trust fabric is being rendered, because we're not giving attentiveness to our communality and our spirituality. And preachers and pundits and prophets aplenty are all decrying the accelerating pace at which this dissolution is happening. And decrying is not a bad thing to do. Cursing the darkness serves at least one important purpose. It makes us aware that we are in the darkness, but it is perhaps a better approach to begin to light a candle by reweaving together the fabric of community and restitching together the practices of spirituality. Now, the Christian church has fallen on hard times this last generation or two. We've lost our moral authority. We've lost our bearings. We've gotten so focused on the details of our religion that we somehow lost sight of the way of Jesus. And that demise is well documented, and lots of people are complaining about it. However, when church is healthy, when church is at its best, it is the place to reweave the fabric of community. It is the place to restitch the practices of spirituality. And we're doing our best at NRCC to be that kind of place, a place of reweaving and restitching, putting back into our lives those elements that are essential for a thriving soul, spirituality, and community. Authentic spiritual community is the term we've been using. Now, if you're familiar with our website, or if you've been around for any length of time, or if you've been to the Newcomer's Pizza, you will have noticed that when we say the term authentic spiritual community, we hit two of the words that make up NRCC's three core values: community, spirituality, and influence. You'll also notice that we always discuss these core values in the same order: community first, spirituality second, influence third. As a church, you might think that we would put spirituality first, because a church's mission is, after all, to experience the divine, the quest for that experience. So shouldn't spirituality be first? And yes, spirituality is very, very important. It is our quest to discern the divine center and live from it. It is our quest to hear the interior voice and be led by it. But we always put community first for a reason. We have discovered along the way that we find the divine better together than we do alone. We find the divine better together than we do alone. Now, in the last 500 to 1,000 years, as the Christian experience has been wed to Western experience, and as Christian experience has been wed to Enlightenment experience, our religion has taken on some profoundly individualistic overtones. The spiritual journey, the religious journey, has begun to feel over the years like something that we do alone. But that, we've discovered together, is like asking the migratory birds that travel the continents each year to do their journey without access to the wetlands. The wetlands, the environment that they need to thrive, without the safety of cover in which they can rest on their journeys, without the nourishment of the brine shrimp that sustains them on their journeys. Asking a Christian to do the religious journey without community is like asking a migratory bird to do the journey without the wetlands. This is the environment that sustains us. This is the environment in which we thrive. Community comes first because it is in community that we do spirituality well. I started asking people this question about 25 years ago. How's your soul? Whenever I'd sit down to chat with somebody, that would be the first question out of my mouth. Now, at this point, folks are used to that question. It often sparks some thoughtful, maybe reflective conversation. But when I began to ask that question, it engendered all kinds of strange looks. Some wanted to argue with me about what the term soul means. Some didn't want to factor the word soul into their answers, and they'd simply begin to tell me about their days, about their jobs, about their struggles. Some were so steeped in the idea that spirituality is a very private and personal matter that they took offense to the question. It was as though I had asked about their bowel movements or about their orgasms or some such thing. It was just like, whoa, that's way too personal, buddy. But the idea that we have a spiritual component to our humanity, and that it is normative to talk about that component with other people, this is, for many in our culture, a foreign concept. that it is normative to question out loud the things that we believe, to wonder about our own human nature, to wonder about the divine nature, to wonder and question the truths that we picked up along the way from our families and from our society, truths that it may turn out to be are not true, that might be at odds with our soul health. To actually have conversations about that kind of stuff seemed to be out of sync. Or that it would be normative to talk about our soul failures, our sin, the things that I want to do that I don't do in my life, the things that I don't want to do that I end up doing in my life, the glimpses that we get of why it is that I act that way, why do I am I led by these instincts, the glimpses that we get into how we're damaging our relationships and how we're damaging our bodies and how we're damaging our minds, how we are living this unhealthy version of ourselves, that we would actually talk about that seemed a foreign concept. That we would talk about these things, and when we were finished, the people with whom we had had that conversation would still love us and still see the divine life in us, still define us according to the divine breath that animates us, as opposed to the veneer that they had seen on the outside. This idea is strange to many. So we are revisiting the idea of spiritual community this fall, doing a lesson over many weeks that talks about how we function well in community, which makes place for a healthy spirituality. And today, as we look at our fourth skill that's necessary to live well in authentic community, I want to talk about a skill that links together how our first two core values, community and spirituality, are interconnected with our third core value, and that is influence. Use what gifts you have to serve one another, our text says. That's the ancient wisdom that is given to us. One of the essential nutrients for a healthy life, one of the essential nutrients for a healthy soul, use what gifts you have to serve one another. Now, the lesson's going to take a few weeks, so let me give you an outline of where it's going to go. Here's what the shape of it's going to be. We're not going to get very far today. Mostly we'll be context setting today. So first, we're going to talk about why it is that service is such an essential element for the healthy soul. Why is it that we are encouraged at every turn in our tradition to use our gifts to serve one another? First, we'll talk about why. Second, we'll talk about why not. Why don't we serve others? Why don't we serve one another? Why isn't this virtue a normative part of our daily lives? If I make the case in the first part, and if you believe me, that serving others is an essential element of our soul's health, the essential component of the good life, then why is it that we don't do it? What gets in the way of this becoming a routine, normative part of our lives? So that's where the lesson will go. Service is an essential skill for authentic spiritual community. Service is an essential element of the good life. First, why is that the case? Second, why don't we do it? However, it will be a circuitous route to get there. And this very roundabout way of getting to it, we won't even get to talking about service today. Today I'm just laying groundwork. I say that so that you will be prepared for how far afield I am about to go. I wanted you to understand that this is where we're going, and that's not where we're going to be right now. So let's start with this. In our ancient texts, Paul uses a term with certain regularity. And like so many other of the spiritual terms that we talk about, it has sustained through the centuries an all-too-common devolution in meaning. It started out as a good term. That term spoke of good and truth and life. But with each passing generation, it has become slightly colored, slightly distorted, so that now when we use the term in 21st century ears, we don't even talk about what Paul is talking about. And the thing that we do talk about is subconsciously so off-putting, we basically reject the idea. The term is flesh. When we hear that today, We do so on this side of a whole lot of theologizing. We do it on this side of a whole lot of meaning making, and we do it on this side of one, at least one, major historical transition that we have talked about before. The Christian life, the Christian religion, our Christian tradition began deeply rooted in the Hebrew worldview. But over the 200 years after Jesus, it was transitioned almost universally into the Greco-Roman worldview. And a lot of spiritual terms, a lot of spiritual concepts had to be reworked in order to fit into this new epicenter of our faith. Whereas before we had talked in Jerusalem in Hebrew terms with Hebrew sensibilities, now we were talking in Rome with Greco-Roman sensibilities and meanings associated with them. And sometimes a concept lost some of its meaning as it made the transition. So recall this. In the Hebrew worldview, the physical world is good. Remember in the Genesis account, it says, this happened, it was good. This happened, it was good. This happened, it was good. This came to be, and it was good. Everything, it is good, it is good, it is good, it is good. Everything about the earth that we live in, everything about the physicality of existence is good. And then we made this transition over to Rome, and we bumped into Plato, or the Neoplatonists. Now, what Plato had said is, out there in the realm of non-physicality, it is good. Here, it's a little derivative. Here, slightly corrupted. Now, by the time we get to the years after Jesus, where we've got the Neoplatonists, they basically said, yeah, it's just not derivative, it's bad. It's kind of corrupt. It's kind of, we're living in this shadow world of lesser good, lesser reality. Well, the word flesh got shoehorned into the it's all bad framework. So flesh has become synonymous with bad actions, bad thoughts, bad deeds, bad, bad, bad. The things that we do in the world of length and width and height, the things that we do in the physicality of our experience that are bad, we call it flesh. Bad words come out of our mouths, that is flesh. Bad things that we do with our bodies, that is flesh. Bad thoughts that we think in our brains, that is flesh. And, as you're fully aware, sex makes the top of the list because it's of being associated with flesh. And so through the years, the church has had a very uncomfortable relationship with sex because it was associated with bad. And then serving vice instead of serving virtue was associated with flesh. Being viceful instead of virtuous was associated with flesh. But when we transitioned that term from the Hebrew worldview to the Greco-Roman worldview, we overemphasized one part of human experience and we underemphasized another. We overemphasized it's bad, it's bad, it's bad, bad thoughts, bad words, bad actions, and we underemphasized a larger construct consideration that ego being the center of self is toxic and destructive. And you find what you're looking for. If we're looking for bad, we will find a bunch of it. If we're looking for the toxic effects of ego as a center, we will find it. The problem has been, because of this transition, we're not looking for that. We're looking for that. We're looking for it is bad, it is bad, it is bad. So the term flesh or the term sin have become reduced to bad actions, bad thoughts, bad deeds. Well, let me give you an example of flesh that has very little to do with a bad action, a bad thought. Because if we look for this kind of stuff, we will find it. My father was an angry man. Now, that's not true because my father was a dead man. My father died when I was 2. But you're going to imagine this with me, okay? You can put your imagination on as I will imagine having had an angry father. In my early years, I made an emotional link between my angry father and God. Without realizing it, I reduced my concept of God to the image of an angry, cosmic, male authority figure living up in the sky. And then, without realizing what I had done, I configured my life then to match that image of God. I configured my life to match that imagination that I had about God. I have configured my life in such a way that I work really hard to be good, because if I'm good, then angry God won't get upset with me. I work really hard to do lots of good things, but I feel guilty a lot because sometimes I come up short. I'm not always sure I've done enough. But as you, as an outsider, might attest, I live a very good life. I have to. If I don't, my cosmic father is going to come along and whack me. So out of fear, I serve this God with diligence. I am good. I am not bad. So if you were to follow me around with a video camera, you would record me doing good things. You would see that I was keeping the commandments. You would see that I was practicing the virtues. You would see that I was practicing the spiritual disciplines. And you could easily miss, if you had a Greco-Roman construct of the word flesh, that that's actually what I was doing. Because we've reduced the concept of flesh down to bad actions, bad thoughts, and bad deeds, you might miss that my good actions, good thoughts, and good deeds are actually flesh. Because it turns out that I'm living according to a truth that is a reduced truth, that is a distorted truth, that is a false truth. And on the basis of that belief in that truth, I'm building up a whole life on top of it. I'm configuring my whole action and response to the world around me on the basis of that untrue truth. And I have a grid through which I make decisions, and that grid is profoundly influenced by that truth that is not true. I build a reputation for good behavior, but I build that reputation on the basis of a truth that is not true. I build a set of religious expectations of myself and my own behavior, but I build that set of expectations about you and your behaviors too, but I build that set of expectations on the basis of a truth that is not true. But now, from your perspective looking at me, and even from my own perspective looking at me, I'm actually building a self that is very well behaved. You would think I'm a well-behaved person, but I'm a falsely built person, which is what we mean when we use the term false self so frequently. The self that I have constructed with the best of intentions, self that I have constructed with the best of outcomes, honestly. I mean, look at me and my fear-inducing God. I'm a good person. I'm doing good stuff. I'm feeding the homeless. I'm giving away my money. I'm not saying the bad words. I am saying the kind words. I treat people kindly. I practice the virtues. What do you mean flesh? Flesh is bad. And I'm working my tail off over here to be good. Now, there is a small problem with this life that I have constructed for myself. It's a small problem. It's not that big. The problem that I have is that I'm getting a little bit tired. Actually, I'm getting really tired. My religion is wearing me out. My good life is wearing me out. My job is wearing me out. Because what happens is, as long as I'm functioning with this low-grade fear of the universe, and that fear is always running in the background, I have to protect myself, which means that I have to do all these good things. I have to give away my money, which means that I have to feed the homeless, which means I have to be nice to the people at work, and especially have to be nice to that lady in the next cubicle because I know she's wounded, and I know she's so hard to deal with, and so I'm being kind to her while everybody else is just shunning her, and I have to serve at the church, and the teenagers really need somebody, and nobody else signed up, so I have to do these things so that I might be pleasing unto the Lord. Or, if I'm really honest with myself, so that I don't get that big celestial whack. But inevitably, this exhaustion starts to catch up with me. That's what happens to truths that are untrue. They're untrue because they don't work. They might work for a little while, but they don't go the distance. And so, any truth that is untrue will, over time, stop working. And I recognize that it stops working when I start getting tired. And in my particular case, the cracks in the facade begin to show when I'm not nice, when I'm short, or when I'm rude, or when I take a shortcut just in order to give myself a little bit of a reprieve, and I do the things that I don't want to do, and I don't do the things that I do want to do because I'm exhausted. And this is the context in which a whole lot of Christians hear the call to service. Service is often, if not usually, an expression of false self. Oh no. Service is often, if not usually, an expression of false self. We do good things for one another because of some belief that we're carrying around inside of ourselves that somehow this is going to make me a good person. Somehow by doing this action, it will make me noble, it will make me virtuous, it will make me pleasing unto God, it will make me pleasing unto people, it will make me even pleasing unto myself. And it will bolster this interior sense that I have about myself. God will be happy, I'll be happy, it's all good, here we go. Service is one of those spiritual skills that when we learn it, it is one that we most commonly respond to with false self-motivation. Now we're talking about the real Doug. I am the very picture of this dynamic because I'm a minister. Let me tell you about ministers. We go into ministry and we get into this business because we wake up inside brains that really do well in this environment. We're good at caring for people. We're good at seeing the spiritual in the everyday. We're good at sensing the interior voice, and we're good at helping people along their journey. So what we do is we embark on lives of service. Here we go. We're young. We're full of energy, and off we go. We go get some training, and then we show up, and we are here to serve. And you people don't help us very much because what you do is you let us do the things that our brains are good at doing, and you say, hey, minister man, that really helped me. So at the end of the day, I walk home and say, I really helped that person. I am good. God is pleased with me. I am pleased with me. People are pleased with me. I am good. And we get exhausted. And that dynamic is true of ministers, and it's true of parishioners. But what happens to ministers can be instructive for all of us, because here's what happens to ministers. We burn out, and we leave the ministry. 1 in 3 goes the distance. 2 in 3 wash out along the way. And most of the 2 out of 3 that wash out along the way do so within the first 5 years. So we just look up and say, I'm sorry, you people have just too much black hole of sucking need going on in your life. I can't take care of it all. I'm going to go sell insurance. Most of us burn out along the way. The other option for ministers is to turn into a zombie minister, and that is keep doing what we once sensed was right, but to be honest, we're just the walking dead. Or a third option. Something powerful and something profound happens to us. And that is, the service that is killing us kills us. Woohoo! Because what service does is it kills off our false self-belief system. The exhaustion of keeping up a pace of service begins to unravel the lives that we had built upon a faulty premise. God loves me to the degree that I do good in the world. This starts getting killed off. I am precious to the degree that I serve other people starts getting killed off. I am important because I'm doing important work, because I'm doing God work. These beliefs begin to die away. I'm good at this, and that's what makes me valuable, gets killed off in the inferno of service. In other words, service is a pathway to what the ancients called the mortification of the flesh, death of the flesh. We serve and flesh dies. Now, as ministers, you know, it used to be true. It's not true anymore. But the whole sex and drugs and rock and roll thing, that wasn't as big a temptation for us. Like I said, not true anymore. But, you know, that wasn't the big temptation. The big temptation was over here on this thing that is also called flesh. But remember, once we made this transition, we're only looking for this. We weren't even looking for that. So we didn't even look at how this might be toxic. And we just kept running and running as though this was true. All the while, it's just adding toxin to the system. All the while, it's killing us. We didn't even look for this. This is the bigger problem. Service begins to kill off flesh. Mortification of the flesh. That's not even words we use anymore. That's how old that term is. It has to do with a spiritual process by which that you have built your life on that is false dies. And service is that. It deals a death blow to our false self. It deals a death blow to the beliefs that we build our lives upon. Service is difficult. Service is challenging. And service is wearing. It gives us a set of priorities that say prioritize others over your false self instincts. And so off we go to do that. And you do that long enough, and you do that consistently enough, and it will break you down. It will wear on you. In fact, it will wear you out. And eventually, something happens. You begin to wear down the false you. Because the wearing, it turns out, is the exact thing that we need to emerge into our true self, divine center self, to become the kind of people who reflect the divine within. The wearing, it turns out, is exactly what we need to be able to live well in authentic spiritual community. Now, I know that most Christians who've been Christians for any length of time have somehow stopped serving along the way, usually for the same reason that ministers leave the ministry. We burn out, and it's true. And if we burn out and we're not looking for flesh, or if we're just looking for bad actions, we can actually build up a sense of resentment. I have served God, and I have been good, and I have done the right practices, and I have said the right words, I have prayed the right prayers, and damn it, this just sucks, I quit. And that is honestly what a lot of Christians do when it comes to service. But that's only because we were only looking for half of flesh. We weren't looking for the other part of flesh that we missed when we became Greco-Romans. The part of us that says that there is inside of me a belief that is not true. Now, but it's making me do such good stuff. It's making me be such a noble Christian person. I am modifying my behavior just about better than anyone. If everybody else would act like I act, well, then this would be a much better planet. What are you talking about? Flesh. And that's flesh. The false self-motivation that makes us do good things is just as toxic, if not more toxic, because we are fooled into believing we're doing something good. But that is no argument against service, just because you're going into it for bad motives. That's actually an argument for service, because here's what will happen. You'll get into that meat grinder, and it will rip you up. That's the argument for it. Take up your cross, Jesus said. Come follow me. And we've always thought that meant you go over here and you just don't quit. You know, no matter how bad it is, you just keep going, you keep going. That's not what it's saying. What it's saying is, come, die. Come, let your false self unravel. Meditation will kill you. Meditate. Service will kill you. Serve. And so we come and we take on these practices for the very reason that they are difficult, for the very reason that they do lead us to the end of ourselves, for the very reason that they do burn us out, because it is that burning that is the necessary part of the spiritual soul. So difficulty is no argument against the ancient virtue of service. The fact that we come to service with selfish motivation is no argument against being faithful in service. Seeing our false self and recognizing that we're operating because of it, this is no argument against faithful service. It is actually an argument for service. Service is a pain to our flesh until the day service kills our flesh. Service is a pain to our flesh until the day that service kills our flesh. And on that day, we praise the wisdom of our ancestors. On that day, we praise the day that we heeded the call to steadfast service. On that day, we praise the pain and we praise the hassle, for we have become more truly ourselves. So, Spirit of God, may we be people of service. And Spirit of God, may we become people of authentic, divine-centered life. In Jesus' name, amen.